Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Dave James. In a moment, I'll talk with someone heading an agency working to stem Ohio's opioid addiction problem. Columbus City Schools are back in session, and courtesy of 10TV, we'll hear from Superintendent Talisa Dixon in about 20 minutes. With schools starting up, concerns grow from health advocates about kids and e-cigarettes. More about that in about 25 minutes. Then, courtesy of 10TV, Scott Light will have a roundtable discussion about gun legislation in Ohio. We're just a few days away from the last big holiday weekend for grilling out. And I'll talk about food safety with the head of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety Inspection Service. First up on Columbus Perspective, joining me on the phone, Alicia Nelson, who is the director of Recovery Ohio. How are you?
I'm good, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for talking to us. Tell me what Recovery Ohio is.
Recovery Ohio is an initiative started by Governor Mike DeWine on his first night in office in recognition that Ohio is dealing with a public health crisis. And that crisis is related to the addiction problems that we have in our state, as well as the mental health crisis, where we have a number of people who unintentionally overdose and a number of people who are completing suicide in our state, and really want to address these issues so that we can keep families together.
And you were working in similar field under then Attorney General Mike DeWine in his office, right?
Correct. Yeah. At the Attorney General's office, Mike DeWine had a heroin unit. I led that team his last year as the AG to really connect communities who were working hard to address the drug issues in our state and make sure that they had the tools and resources they needed to, you know, work collaboratively to help families.
So this opioid problem has been going on for quite a few years now. Is it transitioning into any kind of different phases as we go along?
Absolutely. And I think it's most fitting to start when Mike DeWine was Attorney General, when he closed the pill mills several years ago and really saw that we had a prescription drug problem in our state, and many individuals were accessing drugs like OxyContin and other opioid prescriptions and were being prescribed those inappropriately. From there, we saw a shift to heroin. And for those folks who had previously been abusing prescription drugs, transitioned to drugs, illicit drugs like heroin on the street. And then, you know, most recently we saw in 2017-ish, a shift to fentanyl mixed with heroin. And that's really where we saw a huge spike in 2017 in overdose deaths. Fentanyl is an opioid just like heroin and OxyContin, but it's tens and hundreds of times more potent, and in some cases is causing immediate death. And so, you know, we watched that in 2017, and now, again, we're watching a shift as fentanyl is being included in other drugs like methamphetamines and cocaine, which is, again, extremely lethal. And so it's a problem that's evolved, and it's affecting everybody.
Yeah, that addition of fentanyl being in cocaine or meth, those were drugs that kind of seemed a little bit like they were on the wane, and yet when you mix something that's highly lethal into it, then you realize that it's still there.
Absolutely, and it impacts different communities. And so what we've done this year is started with, under Governor DeWine's guidance, what we're calling the Minority Health Working Group. When we introduced, or when the state started to see fentanyl being mixed in cocaine and methamphetamines, it really took a turn to who was dying from overdose deaths. And we're working really hard to make sure that our communities know that none of these drugs are safe and fentanyl is in everything.
Well, it seems like, you know, I remember last year and the year before stories about morgues being full. And we still hear stories once in a while of, you know, like a dozen overdoses in a few hour period in Columbus or Cleveland or somewhere. But it seems like some of those situations have eased a bit. Is that fair to say?
It's fair to say that we've seen a decline in the number of overdose deaths. in our state. And the CDC most recently reported about a 22% decrease of deaths when you look at 2017 compared to 2018. But what I caution folks is that we're still seeing overdoses and we're still seeing overdose deaths. So it's not quite time to take your foot off the gas. We definitely still have work to do. And, you know, one death is too many. So we want to make sure that we send that message that, you know, what we're doing is hopefully working. We need to still do more of it.
And we're talking about numbers that are astounding, in several thousand per year.
Correct. In 2017, we saw over 4,500 deaths. In 2018, we were still in the high 3,000s. And so, you know, this is still a lot of families impacted. This is still a lot of people that we're losing in our state. Although it's not as bad as 2017, you know, it's not where we needed to be.
Talking with Alicia Nelson, she's the director of Recovery Ohio. You're also working with the Opioid Alliance, and I guess in part some of that is people would be familiar with the Denial Ohio campaign, that type of thing, right?
Yes. We work closely with them, with the Denial Ohio campaign. One of our agencies, Mental Health and Addiction Services, works to spread that campaign on social media because we believe that we need to still raise awareness so that we can avoid folks from, you know, not talking about these issues. The worst thing we can do is act like this isn't happening. Our kids see it at their schools through their peers. Our families see it. We need to definitely discuss these issues to make sure that we prevent them from happening in the future.
Is a lot of the campaigning against usage, it seems like it's kind of a two-pronged problem. One might be people who perhaps engage in it out of curiosity or for recreational uses, but we hear a lot about how people just got hooked on it because of prescription painkillers, that when that prescription ran out, they were addicted and they needed something else.
What we have seen is that about 70 to 80% of those who are struggling with substance use disorder right now got their start with a prescription drug. And so that means the majority of the folks that are struggling started with that, you know, pill and really transitioned. What we also are seeing is the effects of trauma and untreated mental health. And, you know, when people are struggling with depression or anxiety or coping with, you know, some pretty serious trauma that they've experienced in their lifetime, they may turn to, drugs as a source to cope with those issues. And what we really want folks to know is that there's different things that we can do to cope. And what we hope to do is educate, you know, not only the families and the communities through programs like Denial Ohio, but also, you know, our kids who have been surrounded by this epidemic through Governor DeWine's K-12 prevention efforts and what he's done to invest in schools in our community. And we're really proud of the fact that we have in this budget the ability to really support schools so they can have those social and emotional learning experiences to protect, those kids who've seen so much.
What about the availability of beds for folks who need to go into rehab? Is that on the increase?
So treatment access is something that we're taking a very hard look at. And, you know, a lot of conversation has been around the availability of beds, but there is a spectrum of, you know, what people need. And so not all people need particularly a bed, if you will. Some people are in lower severity of their substance use disorder and can do fine just by outpatient treatment. Mm-hmm. Others who are on this, you know, spectrum of worsening severity may need a residential stay in a treatment bed or otherwise. We are doing surveys now to really calculate who has what where and understand, you know, do we have what we need? one of the governor's goals is to increase treatment capacity across the state. And to do that, he invested, over $20 million to the state of Ohio's counties to, you know, do that assessment of what they need and be able to have that discretionary money to purchase what they're missing. So some counties may be missing a bed. Other counties may be missing a treatment or group counseling program for outpatient care. So it really, you know, varies greatly across the state, but we hope that this budget will provide folks the flexibility they need to make those local decisions.
Talking with Alicia Nelson, Director of Recovery Ohio, a few months ago, the federal government announced a huge grant for Ohio State University and a handful of other universities to study down at the county level what's going on. Do you collaborate on that kind of stuff? Do states collaborate with each other on best practices?
Absolutely. And we are a part of the what's called the Healing Community Study, which is the OSU grant that you mentioned that will give our state $65 million over the next 4 years to address this problem in collaboration with Massachusetts, Kentucky, and New York. And so we definitely are working across state lines to figure out what's working well where and how we can replicate success as quickly as possible. We also meet regularly with our, you know, Indiana partners because we share a lot of, you know, county borders and people need help and they don't necessarily look up to say, am I in Ohio or am I in Indiana or Kentucky or Pennsylvania? So we really need to be close with our state partners and understand what we can do to get people well.
There's been an effort to crack down on the distribution of painkillers to pharmacies and also to limit the time that people can be on prescription medications depending on what their ailment is. Are those some of the keys to combating this problem?
Absolutely, some of the keys. They're not, you know, all of the keys, and I think that that's an important piece too. But when you look at the prescription drug issue, we know that, you know, if we can get some of these pills off the streets, then we can potentially avoid another person, you know, building a dependence and unfortunately a substance use disorder as it relates to prescription drugs. And so our Board of Pharmacy is working hard through our state's prescription monitoring system to make sure that doctors know the federal guidelines of use for acute service and other service types so that we can really, you know, lean on those federal guidelines to make sure that we're appropriately prescribing these pretty dangerous drugs.
I guess one of the complications is that even if you reduce, you know, the entry point at which some of these folks are becoming addicted, the problem is you still have thousands of either current addicts or former addicts who could relapse, and then you've got this problem of fentanyl on the street as well.
And I think that I agree with you, and I think that that's why we have to hit this at all sides. And so we have efforts that will reduce the supply of drugs through our drug task forces and our law enforcement initiatives. We also have efforts to reduce the demand of drugs and making sure that folks are dealing with trauma, understanding, you know, the mental health needs that they may have. And then building a recovery ecosystem is going to be an important initiative for Governor DeWine to make sure that those that, you know, go through this really long and hard process to get to recovery have the supports that they need around them to maintain that recovery. So access to peers who have been through the similar, you know, situations that they've been through and struggle with mental health or addiction issues, access to, you know, recovery support groups and family reunification services, as well as parental training. You know, some of these individuals may have, you know, had children and may not be ready, you know, or have all the skills they need to be the parents they want to be. And so we want to make sure that they have access to programs to give them that confidence and rebuild their life so they can live happy, healthy, productive lives.
Alicia Nelson, Director of Recovery Ohio, is there a website where folks can go to get more information or support?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Recovery Ohio is launching in a few weeks our recoveryohio.gov website that will be available that we hope kind of, you know, acts as a resource for all state-related initiatives that are addressing mental health and addiction issues. And so we are excited to launch that in September.
Okay, outstanding. Anything else you'd like to add, Alicia?
I mentioned briefly prevention, but one of the things that we're really proud of is our partnerships, you know, not just with the Opiate Alliance, but with our athletic associations, with our hospital systems, who are really looking at making sure that kids don't go down this pathway with all the sports injuries that they experience. So we've heard story after story, and unfortunately, the governor has talked to parents who have lost a kid, and the stories sound the same. My kid was, you know, a football athlete, a basketball athlete, or played, you know, fill-in-the-blank sport, got injured, and was prescribed a drug. And so we're really proud to partner with our, you know, state associations like the Athletic Association and hospitals to launch a youth initiative that will help make sure that students are protected in these situations and get them physical therapy and other non-medication alternatives so that we can get them and keep them well.
That's great. It shows what collaboration can do, because you've obviously pointed out a number of different avenues that this issue has to be approached, because that's what it's going to take.
And it really is going to take all of us. And from wherever we sit, there's something that we can do. I talk to, you know, barbers all the time. As people try to rebuild their lives, they can offer free haircuts. I talk to teachers who could take a few minutes to, you know, work with a student who may be struggling at home and get them referred to help. I mean, there's something that everybody can do in this epidemic.
And there's so many things about it, too, that, you know, you've got, it could be, you know, a young adult who's still living at home who may be addicted. That's tearing that family apart. It may cause them to turn to theft as a way to feed their addiction, when maybe they're not the kind of person who would ever do that under any other circumstances. It just has so many different elements to it.
Absolutely. And I think the impact on the family is something I can't express enough. I mean, this will traumatize and will cause, you know, all the family to really talk to mental health and substance use treatment providers, because it is devastating to experience.
Alicia Nelson with, she's the director of Recovery Ohio. Anything else you'd like to add?
The recoveryohio.gov website will be up in September for Recovery Month.
Okay, excellent. Thanks so much for the information, Alicia, and good luck.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Todd Markowitz, Vice President and General Manager of Radio Ohio, which owns 97.1 The Fan. We're an equal opportunity employer dedicated to providing broad outreach efforts regarding job vacancies within our company. We seek the help of local organizations in referring qualified applicants. Organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should send their request to the attention of Human Resources, Radio Ohio, 770 Twin Rivers Drive, Columbus, 43215. If you'd like to view our current job openings, please visit our website at 971thefan.com, and thanks for listening.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Courtesy of 10TV, here's a segment from 10TV's morning team, Pete Scalia and Angela Ann.
It's her first full year on the job, and she has some ideas for Central Ohio's, the state's largest school district. Dr. Talisa Dixon's already spent 6 months as superintendent of Columbus City Schools, but kicking off her first full school year. So, Dr. Dixon, thank you so much for joining us here this morning.
Thank you.
You know, you got a chance to meet the students when you first came on board in the spring. But when we spoke with you back in the spring, you talked about after your first 100 days, mm-hmm. you wanted to look at some of the priorities that you wanted to bring to the board this month to say, here's what I want to tackle.
Yes.
What are they?
They're going to be literacy, numeracy, and increase in graduation rates.
Literacy, numeracy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, talk about
that. And graduation rate.
Okay.
So we see that our students, when we look at our data, and we see our students proficient in reading and mathematics, and we see that we want to see those numbers increase. So we decided that that would be our focus, starting with our primary grades and up, and increasing our graduation rates for our high school students. We want more of our students graduating. We've seen some increase from 81 to 82%, but we would like to be in the 90s.
How would you do that, though, with more tutoring, more, like, how would you actually make that effective for the kids?
Well, first, we want to make sure our students are prepared for school and then engaged in their classrooms. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure our teachers have all the resources they need across all of our districts. I realigned the district to 6 regions, so I wanted to make sure we had equity across all of our schools, pre-K through 12, and so that regional focus will allow us to make sure all the supports are there for all of our students across all of our schools.
Well, Dr. Dixon, I wanted to ask too, because obviously, you know, a friend of mine for so many parents with the start of the school year is safety. We know you just hired 31 additional security personnel.
Yes.
So what are they doing to make sure kids are safe?
Oh, I have a very good question. So safety is priority. We know our families want to make sure students are safe first before learning starts. So we have 31 additional, which will be a total of 84 safety and security personnel, including school resource officers. So we were fortunate enough to hire 2 additional resource officers and make sure our schools are safe and that they're also building relationships with our students. So it's one thing to patrol the schools, which is good, but having that, you know, that another welcoming, trusted adult is good for our kids as well.
That interpersonal connection, I think, with the students is what sometimes can prevent perhaps something from escalating.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So you also have 5,000 security cameras across the district-wide, new security on school buses. What about technology advances? Like, what can parents expect from Columbus City Schools with that?
Well, one, we want to make sure that parents recognize that if something happens, we have the technology to investigate. Mm-hmm. That's important. Parents don't want to know, hey, we get back to you in a week. No, they want to know immediately, can we investigate what's happening in our school buildings at any time? And the answer is yes. So we need to, we possibly are going to get more as the years go by, but 5,000, we're pretty satisfied at this point with the number that we have.
A lot of eyes out there.
Yes, yes, yes.
All right, Dr. Talisa Dixon, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you. Thank you.
Courtesy of 10TV, that's Pete Scalia and Angela Ann, 10TV's morning team. This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. This is Dave James. Joining me on the phone is Meredith Berkman, co-founder of Parents Against Vaping E-Cigarettes, and John Schachter, who's the communications director of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing great, thanks.
Thanks for talking to us. We're going to talk about school starting back up, which has folks like you concerned about the ramping up of use of e-cigarettes by students, correct?
Yes, we're facing a serious epidemic of youth e-cigarette use in the United States. And just to put it in context, last year, youth e-cigarette use increased by nearly 80%. And now over 3.5 million high school and middle school students use e-cigarettes. It's a staggering public health crisis, and we need action.
What is the rate of vaping by kids in Ohio?
Well, the numbers haven't been updated real recently, so we expect to see the numbers higher, but we know that e-cigarette youth rate in Ohio is more than 20% higher than the cigarette smoking rate among high school kids. So we're really seeing more kids using e-cigarettes than any other tobacco product, and it's a problem. You know, we've made such great strides in bringing down cigarette smoking rates, especially among kids, and now to see e-cigarette rates outpacing that by far is a serious crisis.
And Meredith, I know that some of the criticism has been aimed at Juul, one of the vaping companies, because you suspect that they've been marketing the products toward kids.
Yeah, rightly so, aimed at Juul, which commands almost three-quarters of the entire e-cigarette market in a very short time. And their original marketing, I mean, this is well-documented, and you know, we've testified about this in Congress, but their original marketing was targeted at kids through social media. And the device itself, which, you know, is stealth by design, resembles a USB drive. So this took parents and public health experts and advocates completely by surprise, because kids were targeted in a medium which the adults really didn't have focus on or access to.
Bubblegum flavored cigarettes, or, you know, cigars or whatever, sounds odd to an adult, but you can't really just say that you can't make that flavor, right?
Well, the FDA is failing us. The FDA has the power to take flavors off the market yesterday, and has talked tough but done nothing, which is really infuriating to parents in particular, because we know from research that the flavors hook the kids. And as you correctly said, you know, what adult really needs cotton candy or gummy bear? As my 12-year-old said, she said, "I'm a kid, and who are these companies kidding? Obviously, they're targeting my age group."
Yeah, 10 years ago, Congress passed a law that did ban flavored cigarettes. So there are no flavored cigarettes anymore. But they exempted cigars, which we need to crack down on the flavored cigars. And e-cigarettes didn't really exist then. So banning flavored e-cigarettes by the FDA or by Congress or by state and local officials is what we are calling for, and what we're going to start seeing more and more around the country.
Now, I've seen people vape before, but I've never tried it, and I'm not a smoker, but I've smoked, you know, as a younger man, I tried a cigarette, and it burned when I tried smoking it. Does vaping do that as well for a first experience?
Well, that's the whole point. These flavors take away the harshness. So, for example, mint, one of the most popular kid flavors, the kids will say, "Oh, someone handed it to me at a party, and I don't know, it was sort of like chewing mint gum, and who doesn't like mint gum?" So that's why the flavors literally hook the kids and initiate them into tobacco use. And as John said, we know that the smoking rates among kids were the lowest ever. So all of the important work can be undone like that, because suddenly kids who would never have used cigarettes are all using e-cigarettes, and they don't perceive any harm because they think it's just water vapor. They don't understand that these products contain highly addictive and large amounts of nicotine and chemicals that can cause, and we see are beginning to cause, potentially cardiovascular damage.
Talking with Meredith Berkman, co-founder Parents Against Vaping E-Cigarettes, and John Schachter, Communications Director, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. So is there any way to actually keep these away from kids or change their attitude? I mean, what's the approach on this, besides going after the companies themselves?
Well, I mean, I think as parents, what we have to do is educate ourselves. As I said, this all happened so quickly and took everyone by surprise. So parents need to understand what they're looking for. They have to know what these what the devices look like, and they have to understand how widespread it is, so that when they're having a conversation as their kids are heading back to school, and hopefully not back to Juul, kids understand that you understand that the proverbial everyone is doing it, because it's true. So you want to understand, you want your kids to understand how dangerous these products are, and that you know enough to look out for it, so that you're really in a conversation, and you explain, you say to your kid, "I don't want to be punitive. I want to be constructive. So if you have a problem, or you think you have a friend who has a problem, let's talk about it and work on it together."
And parents and teachers and kids shouldn't have to do this alone. And that's why we need policymakers and elected officials to step up and really take charge. And that's why we need to see the FDA ban these flavored tobacco products. And if and until they act, we need to see state officials and local officials going state by state, town by town, city by city, and ban these flavored products, get them off the market, which can be done, and protect this next generation from from nicotine addiction.
Ohio is one of those states that has raised the age across the board to 21 for all this kind of stuff, and even Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has expressed an interest in doing this nationally. Do you believe that he's genuine about that?
Well, you know, it's a good first step. Tobacco 21 is important, but it's not going to be as effective in slowing the enormous rate of growth of this crisis. flavors that are hooking the kids.
People can go to parentsagainstvaping.org to get more information about this, or tobaccofreekids.org, learn more about the problems and, more importantly, more about the solutions.
Okay, Meredith Berkman, co-founder of Parents Against Vaping E-Cigarettes, John Schachter, Communications Director, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Thanks for the information.
Thanks, Dave.
Our pleasure.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Courtesy of 10TV, here is Scott Light from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. Here's Scott.
Ohioans demand action, and within just a few days, Governor DeWine responds with a 17-point plan to fight gun violence.
If we do these things, it will matter. If we do these things, it will make us safer.
But people in Ohio also know that there are political plans and goals, and then there's the reality of getting them passed. We're going to talk about it all. Good morning to you. Welcome to Face the State. I'm Scott Light. Let me introduce you to a terrific panel of guests this morning. Longtime Republican strategist, former head of the Franklin County Republican Party, Terry Casey's back with us. State Representative Stephanie House is here as well, Democrat from District 11 from the Cleveland area. We welcome Dr. Amy Whitson. She's joining us today. She's a trauma surgeon, a volunteer medical provider, and also a member of the Physicians Action Network. And Dr. Chanel Jones is back with us. She is the program chair of public safety programs at Franklin University. Welcome all. It's good to have you here. Let's begin the conversation with the governor's plan that the governor wants to do, again, with his 17-point plan. You're hearing not just in Ohio, but several other states talk about red flag laws, and that would enable a judge or a court to take away a gun if someone is deemed dangerous to the community. Also, the governor wants increased psychiatric care. He wants background checks on nearly all gun purchases, and also various increased penalties if people obtain a firearm illegally. State Representative, I'd like to start with you. The governor was pretty roundly applauded for responding quickly. After he was told in Dayton, do something, he came back a couple of days later and said, okay, let's do something. What parts of this plan can you get behind?
Well, first and foremost, I have to thank the governor for actually being responsive and really looking forward to working with his administration to make these things a reality. A couple of things that stand out for me, the red flag laws mm-hmm. of really making sure that we can get firearms out from people that really pose a danger to themselves and to others. I think that's very necessary. Making some investments and trauma, you know, for our mm-hmm. young people. That's one thing that is so real. Like, you know, we know for the beautiful 9 lives that were lost, for those who were injured, there's still a community, a Dayton community that is devastated, that is going to actually be dealing with the aftermath of those things.
Republican strategist Terry Casey.
Well, I think one of the things, not only did the governor act and act quickly, but he now has Lieutenant Governor John Houston from the Dayton area and somebody who's a former House Speaker as the point person with the legislature working on this. And there's a lot of important details, and I'll give you an example why the legislature's got to carefully do its job. One of the governor's proposals is to have common pleas court general division judges decide whether the gun should be taken away or not. But legitimately, they might want to look at whether that be better done in the probate court because they're more used to dealing with people with mental health problems. In a general division court in Franklin County, you got 18 different judges. You could have 18 different ways of looking at things. Cuyahoga County, I think, has got 36 different common pleas judges. So there's a lot of those details, and that's why the legislative process is important. And as we saw in the budget, the House and Senate don't always look at issues in the same mm-hmm. way. So how you put the coalition together is important, but the governor's leadership, the lieutenant governor being involved, those are both very important.
Dr. Whitson, how does the medical community look at this plan?
So I think the medical community is really encouraged that Governor DeWine is taking an interest now in common sense gun laws. It's a great start. The red flag laws proposal and universal background checks are a really good start. But for someone to carry this caliber weapon onto our streets, a .223 caliber military assault rifle, firing 41 rounds in 30 seconds and injuring that many people,
that's really difficult for the medical community to handle. So a lot more has to be done. We also applaud his initiatives to fund more mental illness treatment and psychiatric treatment for patients as well. Mental illness doesn't kill people, though. Guns do. And personally, my best friend, her husband loved guns. He also fought with mental illness, and he was lucky enough to have access to treatment. Mm. He shot himself in the head, left her widowed with three children. So it wasn't the mental illness, it was the gun that killed him. So from a medical community standpoint, yes, we support mental health funding, but also a lot more has to be done to get these assault rifles off the streets and get guns out of the hands of people who should not be using them.
And in the Dayton situation, one of the troubling factors was the school officials and local community people knew there were problems with this individual. But the difficulty is sometimes people say something and do something, and then sometimes it just is left to let slide.
But a red flag law would seem to be made for this particular individual, maybe, with what we know about him now.
Maybe, but you've got to make sure that school and local police officials follow through to the courts or however the legislature designs it.
Let's bring in our resident scholar here who studies this every single day. Dr. Jones, your thoughts?
Well, I think it is a good start, but we definitely need to do more. When you think about it annually, we have about 40,000 people who die at the hands of firearms every year. About 24,000 of that is to suicides, and then another 14,000 is actual homicides that take place from gun violence. Studies have consistently shown, as a matter of fact, Boston University, they published a study earlier this year looking at homicide trends, suicide, and actually looking at the gun control laws. And what they found was that when states, and they looked at all 50 states, they found that when states implemented universal background checks, there were somewhere around a 14% reduction in homicides that were related to firearms. And then the other thing that I want to also highlight, especially when we look at the literature, is when we talk about mental illness. Mental illness is an issue, but hatred is also an issue. And when we have right-wing extremists, when we have white nationalists, when we have that hatred that is ingrained and we tie that to a gun, then we create a situation where it is easily accessible for situations like El Paso and what happened in Dayton to occur. And so we need to also address that, not just the mental illness, not just the access to gun, but also the ingrained hatred.
It's also interesting, too, maybe the tectonic plates here could be shifting when it comes to this issue. I was talking to Republican Senator Peggy Lerner down in Dayton the other day, and she said, you know what? She said, well, first of all, she said she's going to sponsor the red flag bill.
You're going to reintroduce it, and she will be a joint sponsor with Senator Sandra Williams of Senate Bill 19.
And Representative Turner said that he now supports an assault weapons ban. So it may be there. Do you see maybe some shifting?
So again, with Representative Turner, what changed? His baby was there.
That's
his
right.
baby was there. She was across the street when that madness was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, you know, we have many of my colleagues, they don't have to deal with the realities with everyday Americans when it's, you know, from people who are dealing with suicide or just daily shootings, local terrorism that's happening, you know, in our community. A lot of people don't have to feel that pain. It's like, oh, I'm going to send you prayers. But like the days and the months when you are agonizing over your loved one being gone, or you may be the parent of the who is the perpetrator. You know, people are hurting and we can do something about this. Right. And so we really need our colleagues, you know, hopefully so it won't come to your home, right? We can do this.
Mm-hmm. Terry?
Clearly, you've got to figure out what's going to work. And one of the things, I mean, Lindsey Graham, Senator, Chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is talking about doing some things. But even at the federal government, they recognize state governments, empowering and encouraging state governments to do it, because somebody at the local level has got to determine who's fit or who's unfit. And one of the problems with mental health, it's not like some other medical things where you can do a CAT scan or a blood test and you know you have a problem or you don't have a problem, because there's a lot of shades of gray there, and how you sort it out, how you do the due process is important.
Up next, a fresh look. We've got some new data at how Americans feel, how you feel about background checks and bans on assault weapons. We do have a gun violence problem that is unique to America. And a big part of the debate is also this. Do the sheer numbers of guns matter in all this? The number of firearms available to American civilians is estimated at this number, 393 million. That's according to a 2018 report out of Switzerland. Also, we know this. Americans own nearly half of all guns, 46% of the weapons in the world. So let's continue to talk about that. Dr. Amy Whitson, she's a trauma surgeon, a volunteer medical provider, and also a member of the Physicians Action Network. Dr. Whitson, it's interesting to me, if you go back and look at how we, and I should say you in the medical community, Congress forbade the CDC from studying this. That law goes back to the early 90s. So we had this period of 25 years where we said, okay, we trust the CDC to handle the most virulent diseases in the world, but they're not allowed. You know, suddenly they, you know, the folks at the CDC become partisan hacks when they study guns. Now, that law has been changed, by the way. It was changed last year. The CDC can do some studying of this. But I've got to believe that's been a frustration on the part of the medical community, for sure, not being able to study gun violence in our own country.
Right, absolutely. And that those numbers are changing. It has been withdrawn, but for several years we couldn't study gun violence. And we think most of it has to do with the lobbies, the gun lobbies. Mm. The most recent numbers we have, though, from the CDC, which are coming now and that we can actually use the data, the firearm mortality rate in Ohio is up 1.7% from the national average. And then also the firearm homicide rate is 1.3% higher than the national average. And so this is out of the CDC. And so these numbers are real. They're very important, and they're numbers that we have to pay attention to in the trauma community. When I started in medicine over 20 years ago, giving away my age, as a medical student, my first interaction with gun violence was pulling a bullet out of a patient's skull in their jaw. And they were little 22 caliber bullets. Now we're seeing mass carnage. We're seeing very different weapons on a national level, on a local level, and it's terrifying to the trauma community.
Dr. Chanel Jones, the program chair of public safety programs at Franklin University.
The Dayton shooter used an AR-15 style weapon, but he had a double barrel that held like 100 additional rounds. There is absolutely no reason why your average citizen needs anything like that. And then if somebody goes to purchase that, we all should be raising a red flag. Like, what are you going to do? You know, I mean, hunting does not require all of that. And so that is a problem. And the reality is, going back to the background checks, when we think about the sheer number of people who have guns, about 20% of them, 20% of them got their guns without a background check. Mm-hmm. That is a problem. And so we definitely need to address it. And had we been able to research this a long time ago, had the CDC, we as criminologists would be better informed to understand, okay, what are the causes of gun violence and mm-hmm. how do we effectively address them?
I love it when guests lead us right to our next point. Let's talk about those background checks. The latest Politico Morning Consult poll, and this number has held steady for years now. 91% of Americans support background checks. And then look at these other numbers. 86% of Democrats support an assault weapons ban. That's probably not a surprise, but maybe this next number is. 55% of Republicans told Politico and Morning Consult that they would support an assault weapons ban. Do want to point out, though, this poll was conducted between August 5th and 7th, so right after what happened in El Paso and right after what happened in Dayton. So maybe those numbers could be just a little bit inflated, but Republican strategist Terry Casey. Terry, I'll come back to that background checks. That 90% and above has been consistent for years.
Right, but one of the difficulties, like the shooting that happened down in Texas with the former military guy, is he had problems in the military, but it was never reported. It was never put into the system. So you can have background checks, but you got to make sure things are reported and that the systems work. And the other legal aspect, John Kasich made the point over the weekend on CNN that he originally voted for an assault gun ban, but if you don't write a ban or a law correctly and tightly enough, then people can find ways around it. So when you legislate, you've got to write it very carefully so there aren't easy loopholes for people to get around. But background checks sound good, but you've got to make sure, as failed to happen in the Dayton area, if local school and local police people don't report appropriately a guy as a danger, if he doesn't get in the system, then how does the background check system work?
State Representative Stephanie House, a Democrat from the Cleveland area.
I would say we cannot allow, we know the legislative process is a process, right? And we know right now we have laws on the book where there's plenty of loopholes, but we still do it. right? And so beginning to actually take action, setting up the systems in place will only put Ohio in a better position to make sure we can protect our citizens. It's not okay, it is not acceptable for any legislator to say, oh, we're not going to take action because we want to make sure it's going to be perfect. We are imperfect people. We mm-hmm. are not going to necessarily get things perfect, but we have good evidence on things that we can do to make Ohioans safe. And universal background checks is something that will definitely help to make Ohioans safer.
I wonder, I'll throw this out for the table, and I saw that Buckeye Firearms, a very prominent Ohio gun rights group, they said this on the red flag law that the governor proposed. He said they, referring to the DeWine administration, they have gone to great lengths to protect our due process rights. And I see that as very critical. I don't see us fighting this at all. I think that's a good sign coming out of the gate here, wouldn't you say, Dr. Whitson?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's why the legislative process, some people say, do something and do it right now, but you want to do it right. And that's the good thing about the legislative process is you really, when you're sitting there in the legislature, need to think, what are people going to do to kind of skirt the law or avoid the law and make sure you write it, tight enough. So you never get it perfect, but it's important. Just background checks by themselves aren't good unless all the administrative and the other mechanisms work. And also, Ohio is a state where we're in Columbus, and we can drive 2 hours one way to another state, 2 hours to Indiana. Federal action is important. State action's important, too. But you want to do it right and do it smart.
Governor said,
in the midst of doing it right and doing it smart, we need to do something. And so, you know, that at least would be a start so we can inform it. Us researchers can research and see what works, what doesn't work, and then we can use the legislator to go back and make some revisions. That's why we have the amendment process.
Are we seeing this accumulated emotional toll that might drive the politics of gun violence in another direction? Dr. Whitson, start us off here. Is there maybe a tipping point that could be happening, not just in Ohio, but maybe nationally? What do you see out there overall on this?
Definitely the stress of this is affecting people overall. I mean, we see people coming into the trauma bays after their loved ones have been shot, after we have to go talk to them about how it's impacted their communities. People are absolutely torn apart, and there is no complacency. There is a constant release of hormones that makes people really, really nervous about this on a daily basis, and it impacts communities, it tears communities apart. It disallows children from being able to study in school, because when they have to go to school and they're worried about the next lockdown drill, the next mass shooter, because they're talking about that with their teachers, who then can't educate them properly. I mean, these are the conversations that we have to have as medical providers in the mm-hmm. community. It does. It stresses all of us, and it is getting worse and worse. There's nothing normal about it. I don't want to say this is a new normal. Mm. It's just getting worse, and it's way past the time to nip it in the bud.
But on the red flag law, Connecticut was the first one to pass such a law in 1999. It didn't stop, sadly, Sandy Hook in 2012. But we were up to 5 states that had red flag laws before Parkland, Florida. Now we're up to 17. So we're making some progress. People are looking at things. And again, I see in terms of some of what the president said, what Senate leadership on the Republican side has said, Governor DeWine, things are moving. But again, it's a matter of you just can't snap your fingers and make it happen overnight. But there is some progress. There is some movement.
Of those 17 states, though, 5 of those were signed into law by Republican governors.
Yes.
I mean, Republicans are talking about this.
Right. No, it's a real issue. It's a matter of, and I think, again, to the credit of Mike DeWine as governor and John Houston as lieutenant governor, they're trying to build a consensus rather than just trying to force one size fits all mm-hmm. for the whole state. So they're trying to really come at a legislative solution. And I think there's some real leadership, as we saw in the budget. There's a lot more bipartisanship in the Ohio General Assembly. So I think there's a good chance to get something actually effective that'll work done.
It was interesting. You mentioned Parkland, and Dr. Jones, I'm sure you watched what played out in Florida after that, because you know what? Those young people got state laws passed.
They did.
And state laws changed in Florida, and they got it done quick.
They did. And, you know, that shows what happens when everybody comes together and they try to affect meaningful change. And the reality is we've had gun violence happen for years in our country, since the beginning of it. And I think finally people are reaching that tipping point where it is getting into their communities, they're getting fed up, and people want change. When you think about it, we are the only people who let some lettuce be tainted, and we are taking it all off the shelves immediately. immediately, but let mass shootings happen. It's going to take one mass shooting and another mass shooting and another mass shooting and another mass shooting, finally, for people to say, okay, we need to do something about it.
I hope, you know, Ohioans actually put the necessary pressure on us as legislators, regardless if we get reelected or not, to make Ohio safer, because it's that important. You know, and again, for legislators who want to cast blame and, you know, throw out very vile and nasty things, that they should be dealt with too. You know, we all have elections, and but our responsibility is to make Ohio better for all, Republican, Democrat, whatever. Ohioans don't care about our political affiliations. They want us to do our jobs and make Ohio safer.
I think that's a good way to end it on this Sunday morning. I appreciate you all.
Thank you.
And talking about a very, it's a touchy subject, and it's tough to talk about. I remember when I was in Dayton, one person said, you know what, sometimes the people on both edges of this debate get the most attention. What about me here in the middle? You know, and I think that's where we need to stay sometimes, again, because sometimes the people shouting the loudest are going to are on the edges there. So the debate will continue for sure. I'd love to have you back on another Sunday. So the invitation is always there.
That's again Scott Light, courtesy of 10TV, from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
Wherever you call home, the sounds of wildlife connect you with the greater family of life. I'm Ed Begley Jr., and when you see habitat being destroyed, you know that wild animals are losing their homes, the greatest threat to their survival. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust offers a humane solution, helping private landowners to protect habitat as permanent safe havens for wildlife. Your voice can speak for wildlife and their homes. Visit the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust at wildlifelandtrust.org.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Long ago, you wouldn't think of galloping on a horse while doing calligraphy, and you wouldn't have attempted to ride your bike while typing a letter. Yet you think you can safely operate a multi-ton vehicle while texting? Behind the wheel is no place to multitask. If you want to BRB, drive now and text later. Lives depend on it.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, Noise, and the Ad Council.
Did you know that prescription pain relievers have contributed to more overdose deaths than cocaine and heroin combined? Talk with your kids about the dangers of medicine abuse. Visit drugfree.org to learn more. A message from the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Hi, this is Dave James. Joining me is Carmen Rottenberg, who is the administrator for the Food Safety Inspection Service through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for talking to us. Tell me briefly what this Food Safety Inspection Service is.
The Food Safety Inspection Service is the federal government agency in the Department of Agriculture that has regulatory authority over meat, poultry, and processed eggs. So we're making sure that the meat consumers eat is safe and wholesome and properly labeled.
So I would guess there are, what, thousands of inspectors across the country that you kind of oversee?
That's correct. We have approximately 7,000 inspection personnel around the country.
And we're going to talk about handling of meat at home as the holiday approaches. But in general, how is the food safety condition these days with, meat distributors?
Well, we have in the United States, we're fortunate to have the safest food supply in the world. And our inspectors are in establishments every day ensuring that the food consumers purchase is safe and wholesome. That said, there is bacteria on meat and poultry. It's not sterile, and so consumers have to properly handle meat and poultry in their own kitchens, and there are some really simple ways that consumers can do that.
Okay, and by the way, we'll mention it again later, the website foodsafety.gov includes recalls and also food safety preparation at home, a good website. What's the biggest concern you have on a big holiday weekend for grilling out and that type of thing?
Well, you know, we've been conducting a series of meal preparation studies to evaluate consumer food handling behaviors in a test kitchen. Previous research that's been done has shown us that consumers self-report that they have really excellent food safety behaviors. But what we have found in these observational studies is there's some really basic things like hand washing that consumers aren't doing or attempting to do the vast majority of the time. And even when they do attempt to wash their hands, they're not doing it correctly. So that's one really big takeaway from the studies that we're doing. And that's the clean step. You always want to wash your hands, not your meat, and you want to sanitize your surfaces. The other thing is to separate raw meat and poultry from any of your prepared foods or your produce. So what we find is that consumers, you know, we can track by using a harmless tracer microorganism, we can track the bacteria that travels around the kitchen. And so even if you've cooked your food to the proper temperature, if you have then cross-contaminated bacteria onto a salad, for instance, then people in your household can get sick. And so those are the really two big messages that I want to communicate today is hand washing and also sanitizing surfaces and making sure that consumers are not cross-contaminating. The last thing is really cooking food to safe internal temperatures. So for poultry, that's 165 degrees. For your burgers, it's 160 degrees. The only way you can tell if meat and poultry is done is if you use a food thermometer. You cannot tell by cutting into it.
Okay. You mentioned about not washing meat, and I did see a study recently that said that any impurities on the skin of meat you'll cook it off and kill it. And if you wash it, you're at a greater risk of just splashing contaminated water around the kitchen.
That is exactly right. And that's what we tell consumers. And this latest iteration of the study that we've conducted was really to look at the behavior of people who are self-reported poultry washers. So people who say, yes, I wash my poultry and I always wash my poultry. So we studied those behaviors in the kitchen and also studied some food safety messaging to see if we delivered food safety messaging about not washing poultry ahead of them preparing food in the kitchen, whether that would have an impact. What we found is that the people who washed the poultry had a much greater chance of having the contamination spread throughout their kitchen, both in the sink, around the sink, on their hands, on other surfaces. And it's not doing anything to make the washing your poultry doesn't do anything to get bacteria off. The only way that you can safely kill that bacteria is by cooking it to the safe internal temperature. So the poultry washing doesn't add anything, and in fact, it can actually do more harm.
Talking with Carmen Rottenberg, she's the administrator of the Food Safety Inspection Service. If there's a backyard barbecue with hamburgers and maybe, pork, chicken, and a lot of little kids or maybe elderly around, what are the big things about the person who's in charge of all that cooking? What do they need to know?
Yeah, so that's really important because we know that for children and for elderly people and those that are immunocompromised, they're much more susceptible to foodborne illness. So really keeping separate plates and separate cutting boards for raw food and cooked food or the raw meat and the fresh vegetables, right? You want to have completely separate plates or separate cutting boards for those items that you avoid contaminating, cross-contamination. You also want to make sure that you're washing your hands every single time that you touch raw meat, so that you're not spreading that then over to prepared foods. And then for burgers especially, you need to make sure that the food is cooked to a safe internal temperature. And for burgers, that's 160 degrees. You want to make sure that you use a food thermometer because you can't tell if the burger is done simply by looking at it. And then for backyard barbecues, one thing that always makes me nervous is if it's a really hot day, you can only keep food out for an hour. If it's over 90 degrees, that food has to be packed up in small containers and put in the refrigerator to get that temperature down, because if not, you do run the risk of having bacteria grow very quickly at those really hot temperatures outside. So we say keep hot foods hot, keep cold foods cold. You can do that either with chafing dishes and ice under bowls if you're outside. But if you don't have a mechanism to keep them hot and to keep them cold, then you do need to pack them up and get in the refrigerator. Eat the food and then get the leftovers in the refrigerator.
So if a hamburger is pink inside, a cooked hamburger, it may or may not be okay, right?
That's correct. I've tested hamburgers that look brown in the middle and they're not cooked to 160 degrees, and I've tested burgers that are slightly pink in the middle and are cooked to 160 degrees. So you just don't know. There's a lot of different reasons why burgers and the thickness of the patty, whether it's frozen or fresh, you just can't tell by looking at it. You have to use the food thermometer.
And last question, if somebody gets sick because of contaminated meat, what are they feeling, what are they doing, and when should a group of people be concerned about it?
Yeah. So the common signs and symptoms are vomiting and diarrhea. It doesn't always happen immediately. So it can happen actually days after you've eaten something that has harmful bacteria that's made you sick. And so we always recommend that consumers go to see their physician if they do have symptoms and suspect foodborne illness.
Okay, Carmen Rottenberg, she's the administrator of the Food Safety Inspection Service through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Thanks for the information.
Thank you so much.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM, that's 1460 ESPN Columbus, and Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM, Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. Join us again next Sunday for Columbus Perspective.